such a nice setup in the attorney room for us to watch.
Well, we're glad you enjoy it. We prefer having you, though, in the courtroom, so. not before your argument, but right now. We're very grateful to be back in person, is what I'm trying to say, in a very indirect way. This is better, isn't it? Yeah. So, good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I see the lawyers are here for the second matter, two out of three on our oral argument calendar. Marshall, would you please call the second case?
Calling case A210938, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Ron Wesley Epps, Appellant.
All right, and counsel, I'll make just a few brief remarks. I know both of you are familiar with our proceedings, but I just want to remind you of a couple of things. When you do go to the podium, that's adjustable up or down. Please take a moment if you'd like to adjust it. Please, before you start your remarks, identify yourself for the record as well as the client that you represent. And then keep an eye on the clock. It tends to go quickly. And I think we need to give them 15 minutes is what I see. So with that, I think we're ready to proceed. And counsel for appellant, you can do that when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Eric Withall. I'm an attorney with the Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear before this court today representing the appellant in this matter, Ron Epps. Your honors, we are lawyers, not psychologists, and that makes us experts in the law, but not experts in mental health. And this reality highlights the import of the Rule 20 process to protect a defendant's right to be competent when he's convicted of a crime. And this fundamental right forms the basis for the two issues before the court today. And the first issue asserts that Mr. Epps should have been evaluated for competency before the court accepted his guilty plea or sentenced him. And the second issue is that his lawyer should have conducted a reasonable investigation into his client's mental health during the course of representation. So I'd like to start with the second issue, the ineffective issue, and I'm advocating for an objective standard of reasonableness that requires defense counsel to investigate their client's mental health relevant to competence. So the rule that I'm asking this court to enforce is that at a minimum, when a defense counsel is aware of a prior opinion on competence, defense counsel has to read it.
So I'm going to jump right in. There don't seem to be any precedential decisions in this area. There are a number of non-precedential decisions, however, many of which I noticed are yours. And I'm wondering whether you think this is an area that requires a precedential decision, and if so, if the rule you just articulated would be the rule that you're requesting.
Yes, and I think this panel is actually pretty familiar with some of these decisions. I know Judge Siegel and Judge Bratfold were on two of the Trevino cases, and Judge Gates, I know that you were on O'Neill recently. So, yeah, I think that there needs to be some kind of standard to inform attorneys, the bench, and the bar what they're required to do in the face of mental illness. Mental illness is prevalent in criminal cases as a whole, but you know, we're asking lawyers to look at prior opinions on mental health to look through the right lens to be able to recognize whether that mental illness has an impact on their client's competence. It's just like a lawyer evaluating a legal issue. They don't shoot for the hip and go on feeling. They do research. They do.
Are you asking for a rule that requires all defense attorneys to investigate as a matter of course a client's mental health?
Yeah, I think that duty exists, but it's more of a combination of the general requirement for duties for attorneys to conduct a reasonable investigation into all matters in a case, but it's more important in the context of the right to be competent because clients need to play a role. They need to be a participant in the criminal case. They need to make decisions. They need to waive rights. So in the face of mental illness, evidence of mental illness, the lawyer doesn't need to be quick on the trigger and ask for a Rule 20 immediately. They need to do some sort of investigation. So one of the things that the court struggled with in Trevino is how much investigation is necessary in these cases. I don't know if the court struggled, but certainly didn't assert it. In saying that nothing is not the answer, I think that the application is, if the lawyer has prior opinions on competency, they have to read the prior opinion on competency, because that's going to guide the entire course of their representation.
The district court relied on a non-precedential decision of this court, Adebayo, for the rule that it applied in analyzing your argument. And the standard articulated there was that an attorney's performance is deficient if a reasonably competent attorney would have doubted the defendant's competency and would have requested a competency evaluation under similar circumstances. That sounds completely different than what you're proposing here.
To determine what a reasonable attorney would do when deciding whether to move for the competency evaluation itself, the attorney needs to be sufficiently educated and informed on the symptoms related to competency. So there's mental health symptoms. Clients can act out all sorts of ways that they can be disruptive or be problematic in a case or difficult to deal with, I think is a word that comes up in this case. The competency evaluation, reviewing it, educates the lawyer on whether the client's behaviors are relevant to competency. So investigating mental health is important in all contexts, but it can become more relevant dispositionally to argue for a departure or why someone's particularly amenable to probation. In this case, we're talking about competency, and all we're asking the court to do is to enforce the rule that, or to create a precedential decision today with the rule that if a prior competency opinion exists and the lawyer is aware of it, it's deficient performance as a matter of law to not investigate it, to read the report. So,
finish your thought.
No, so I acknowledge that it's somewhat of a different articulation of the rule, but it's an extension of the reasonable attorney standard under Strickland. So, you know, Strickland talks about a duty under, or what's reasonable under a well-established duty. So attorneys do have this well-established duty to move for a competency evaluation when there's reason to doubt. That's 2001.
What if a defense attorney has no information concerning a client's mental health and the client is not exhibiting any symptoms that cause the attorney to have concern? I mean, under your rule, it sounds like it doesn't really matter. The attorney would engage in deficient performance if there had been a prior evaluation.
The problem with that, Your Honor, is the difference between a subjective and an objective standard. So an attorney's subjective failure to recognize symptoms of mental illness and their individual failure to conduct an investigation is different than an objective standard. If the client is exhibiting behaviors that are consistent with mental illness, but the lawyer just doesn't recognize them to be consistent with mental illness, kind of like the lawyer here, it doesn't change the reality that the behaviors overlap almost completely between the symptoms presented in court and the symptoms relied upon in the competency evaluation in the previous opinions. So that's why we think it's so important that the attorneys do the investigation to be able to recognize that, A, the behaviors are symptomatic, and, B, that they impact competency.
So is there any evidence in the record that Dr. Cranbrook knew that there had been all these reversals? I mean, that's something the district court relied on, is saying, wait a minute, that's not delusional. I mean, this guy has had several cases kicked, dismissed, at least a couple reversed by our court. I mean, that's kind of rational skepticism of the system. It seems like what the district court was saying. Is there anything in the record that lets us know if Dr. Cranbrook knew that or not?
I want to address the court's comment, the district court's comment on that before I answer. It says, this court finds that it is not necessarily unreasonable for petitioner to distrust the court system given the results of his past cases. That's a pretty cynical perspective. Maybe it's an indictment on the district court itself, or maybe it's a shot at the Court of Appeals for reversing them. I'm not sure which one it is. I don't know whether Dr. Cranbrook had a lot of insight into the actual criminal convictions or the postures of the appeals after those convictions, but Dr. Cranbrook identified at least four instances where Mr. Epps expressed delusions consistent with what she observed during those evaluations. And that's just the plea. Before we get into the stuff that happened at sentencing that is much more clear that there are delusions, Dr. Cranbrook identified these statements that Mr. Epps made in the transcripts. I have had time and time after time, I just can't go through with this. I've just been going through too much with the judicial system, which is not fair to me, and I just want to be left alone. Dr. Cranbrook testified at the post-conviction hearing that that was consistent with his persecutorial delusion that there's a government conspiracy against him, and that's the reason why he's being prosecuted for these cases. You take that statement on its face, is it obviously bizarre or obviously delusional? Probably not. But when you look at that statement in the context of his history of being evaluated for competency and the evaluator's reliance on statements just like that to say he lacks the ability to understand the proceedings, rationally participate in his defense, and rationally consult with counsel, three.
If we're applying an objective standard, I mean, aren't we also required to consider the experience of the attorney below, 21 years of experience in representing clients, many of whom have mental health issues, but may not be incompetent? And aren't we required to also consider the deference that's typically owed to a district court judge in making assessments based on, face-to-face interactions?
An attorney's individual assessment of their client, whether they're an experienced or inexperienced attorney, is necessarily a subjective interpretation of how they view their own client. And with respect to the deference owed to the district court's findings, I would really encourage this court to apply the standard in Bauer, where the Supreme Court said that, and it's applying the same standard applied in Drope and Pate versus Robinson, the Supreme Court cases, that where there is a prior medical opinion on competence, the district court can't disregard that opinion on incompetence. So the same deference that's typically owed under a abuse of discretion standard or clear error, Bauer said that that's not the standard of review in these cases where competency at issue, that district courts aren't free to just disregard the opinions of qualified mental health professionals, which brings me back to my opening. It's because we're lawyers, not psychologists, that the Rule 20 process necessarily requires a mental health expert, a doctorate-level mental health expert, to apply their training and experience and the science behind all of that to evaluate the individual defendant. So the court can't just say, I'm not going to give deference to the psychologist's opinion, or I'm going to disregard what the psychologist's opinion is on what it means in the context of competency when Mr. Epps is talking about being a victim of government abuse. Dr. Cranbrook expressly said that this goes beyond a cynical view of the system and enters into the realm of delusion. The district court cannot ignore that. So to the extent that the district court either found expressly or impliedly that Mr. Epps did not express delusions at his plea hearing, that directly conflicts with Dr. Cranbrook's testimony.
But Dr. Cranbrook also testified that she could not opine on his competency at the time of the plea because she didn't investigate him. All she was doing with very artful questioning by counsel was saying, oh, this is similar to what I saw before, this is similar to what I saw before, right?
Thank you, Your Honor. Respectfully, it doesn't matter whether she can opine on his competence at the time of the plea because that's not the legal standard. The legal standard is whether at the time of the plea there was reason to doubt his competence. And those are two very different things. I mean, Justice Meyer and Bonga reminds us in their concurrence and her dissent in both of those cases, that's a very low standard for reason to doubt, as opposed to actual finding of incompetence need to be supported by a preponderance of the evidence.
So if we were to go along with you and say, yep, there really should be, you know, in the best interests of protecting defendants' rights, there really should be, you know, kind of a rule imposed. What are the limits? I mean, you know, how far back? What if it's a competency eval in another state? What if it's what if? I mean, what are the reasonable bounds?
If we're likening this case to Trevino, if the lawyer knows about it, they have to at least read it. So I think that...
No matter how old the prior competency evaluation is. I mean, don't they get stale at some point, depending, obviously, on the circumstances?
The only way to know its relevance is to read it. I mean, if it's talking about a delusional disorder, the type of delusional disorder that Dr. Cranbrook testified just doesn't ever go away and likely worsens over the course of time, I think it's quite the opposite of being stale. I think it becomes...
Tell me it doesn't ever go away, but, you know, if I'm accurately remembering, and I may not, you know the record better than I do, but if I'm accurately recalling Dr. Cranbrook's evaluations of Mr. Epps, they were in a series, and ultimately Dr. Cranbrook concluded that he was competent. The end of that series.
After 2 years in the fourth evaluation.
So what, did they go away? I mean,
No, and first of all, Dr. Cranbrook's evaluation itself relies on historical records and goes back in time and highlights the relevance of prior evaluations, Mr. Epps's prior stays in mental health hospitalizations. But the other part of Dr. Cranbrook's, and take a close look at the conclusion in the fourth evaluation, it's just because he wasn't expressing those delusional statements in their interview. And she said in that conclusion that if those delusional statements resurfaced, he should be evaluated. I see my time is up. I'll address the rest in rebuttal.
And, of course, you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose. So I think we have reset the clock, and counsel for respondent, you can begin when you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent respondent State of Minnesota in this matter. The post-conviction court acted well within its discretion when it denied relief in this case. The record here does not establish by a fair preponderance of the evidence that there was reason to doubt appellant's competency at either the plea or the sentencing in this case. Therefore, appellant has failed to establish his claim that his due process rights were violated or that he received ineffective assistance of counsel. The fatal fact for both of these claims is that there was no reason to doubt his competency. And this court can look to the transcripts of the plea and sentencing hearings themselves, as well as the testimony from the post-conviction hearings, where we heard from the parties that were present and interacting with the appellant during that time. The Rule 20 process, and to get to the point of ordering a competency evaluation, is predicated on there being doubt about a person's competency. The rule imposes a duty on defense counsel, the prosecutor, and the court to be aware and cognizant of each defendant's competency.
So it seems like Mr. Whistle's arguing that when you've got a significant mental illness, a delusional disorder, such that, I mean, in this case, the appellant was found not competent over a long stretch of time, actually, and not that long ago. I mean, why isn't it incumbent on defense counsel, at least, who would be in the best position to assess the competence of their client, to do some kind of investigation just to make sure?
Because when looking at competency, the question is whether the client has the present ability to consult with their attorney, to understand the process, to participate in their defense. So the defense attorney appropriately and reasonably was looking at his client at that present time and saying, you know, and said in the post-conviction hearing, I had no problem communicating with him. I had no problem understanding him. I had no doubt that he understood the charges against him, the options available to him, you know, the possible outcomes for this case, and no problem articulating back to the attorney the client's wishes and how he wanted to proceed. And because the counsel saw no deficiencies there and no concerns in that present ability to consult, it's unreasonable to impose a broader duty to go back and pour through records from 7 to 8 years ago, you know. And I think it's important to note that the defense attorney was aware that he had been found incompetent in, you know, several years ago in a different case, found incompetent and then eventually found competent, and then had several years of having different criminal cases work through the system, never having any other competency determinations, and then working with him in this case and not seeing any issues, not having any trouble communicating with him or getting the information he needed back.
He did acknowledge there was some trouble, that he had to redirect his client, that, I mean, it wasn't,
Yes, and I
think... client was, you know, in great form at all times.
And I think, as Your Honor mentioned earlier, you know, part of the explanation for that is Mr. Epps's unique criminal history. He's had several Danko violation convictions against a victim who wants contact. He has several Danko violations from Dankos where the underlying case that the Danko was imposed on was ultimately dismissed or reversed on appeal.
Appellant argues that the district court could not just ignore Dr. Cranbrook's testimony. And basically, the district court, said, wait a minute, just as you're arguing, this is rational because they were, you know, so I'm rejecting Dr. Cranbrook's testimony, but that was the only expert testimony at the post-conviction hearing.
That's true. However, the expert was not able to give an opinion, as you mentioned, on appellant's competency at the time of plea or sentencing in this case, and she was not able to give an opinion as to whether there was reason to doubt his competency at that time. I asked her questions on that in the post-conviction hearing, and she said, you know, she didn't know really, she couldn't speak to the difference between the reason to doubt standard versus the incompetency standard, because she's only ever involved after reason to doubt has been established. So, and because there was no reason to doubt in this case, no one ever raised any doubts. The Rule 20 process and procedures were never triggered. And I also think in the post-conviction order, you know, I don't think that the post-conviction court, you know, cast aside or disregarded Dr. Cranbrook's testimony. I think she took that along with all of the evidence to come to the conclusion that there was no reason to doubt at the time of the plea and sentencing. I would note in Dr. Cranbrook's evaluations from 2014 when she found him incompetent, she noted at least three overt and specific delusions that he was espousing at that time. And then in 2015 when she opined him competent, he was no longer expressing those specific delusions, and those specific delusions are not present in the transcripts from the plea or sentencing in 2021 in this case either. And so when you look at it, you know, the aggregate of the evidence, as the court must do, you know, I think the court did consider Dr. Cranbrook's testimony as well as her evaluations along with the defense attorney's credible testimony, the prosecutor's credible testimony, the probation officer's credible testimony, where none of them ever had doubt as to his competency. Appellant today is advocating for a bright line rule that imposes a duty on counsel to read any incompetency evaluation, and as he's saying, you know, with no limits. At any time in the past, no matter what is happening with the appellant and with the defendant at the present time. And I submit that that's just an unworkable and unreasonable duty to impose on defense counsel. You know, I don't know that this case merits a precedential opinion. I believe that the established standard set out in case law, as well as the Rule 20 standard, sets forth what the duty is on defense counsel, as well as...
I agree with the district court's articulation of that duty in its order. I mean, and this is a question I'd ask Mr. Withall. The district court applied a standard in the Adebayo case that performance is deficient if a reasonably competent attorney would have doubted the defendant's competency. Is that the correct standard?
I believe so. I think that follows Strickland very closely. I think it's just looking at, you know, what in a objectively reasonable attorney under these facts and circumstances, would they have doubted the competency?
So is it your position that all we need is Strickland, that, you know, that's sufficient guidance for attorneys, you know, defense attorneys and district court for determining, you know, what their obligations are with respect to competency?
Not just Strickland, but the case is more specific to, you know, a duty to investigate and the Rule 20 standard of when, you know, that if there is doubt as to someone's competency, that they must raise it. That's an affirmative, you know, very clear duty. If there's doubt, you must raise the issue. And then the court's duty is triggered that it must determine whether there's sufficient reason to doubt to then order an evaluation. So I think all of those taken together, you know, I think there's case law on duty to investigate, and, you know, an incomplete investigation isn't necessarily objectively unreasonable if it's from a reasoned strategic decision that the defense attorney is making. And so I think that factors in too. And so in this case, the fact that the defense attorney was consulting with his client, was spending time talking to his client, you know, the defense attorney testified that he printed off registers of action of Mr. Epps' old cases to really understand what Mr. Epps was saying, and that he did understand what Mr. Epps was saying. He said that, you know, Mr. Epps had a point, that there were these cases from 2011 that had been reversed. There were cases that had been dismissed. So that my point is that the defense attorney was taking the time with his client to understand what he was arguing for, to understand what this case was about, to understand where his client was coming from. And that was his duty. That's his job. And throughout all of that consultation and representation, he did not have any doubt as to appellant's competency. And so I think it's a case-by-case analysis. I don't think it's appropriate to have a bright-line rule in these cases. The attorneys must look at the, you know, whether the client has sufficient present ability to rationally consult. And if they do, they don't have a duty to go back and pore through old records. And that's the state's position.
Can a decision not to request an evaluation ever be strategic? I mean, the attorney here testified that he had concerns about the amount of time it might take to get an evaluation done. To me, that suggested there was some strategy involved. Is that ever appropriate in this circumstance?
If the defense attorney has doubt as to the client's competency, I do not believe that it could be a strategic choice to not, or, you know, not request an evaluation. I think that would be, you know, that does implicate the due process rights that appellant is raising. I think just under the facts of this case, the record shows that there was no reason to doubt the competency in this case. And so I think, you know, then when he doesn't have doubt as to the competency, then it is strategic and reasonable to not request records and not request an evaluation, because that would drag on a process that he believes would come back showing that he's competent.
So, counsel, I'd like to ask you, you're obviously viewing the record in a light favorable to the district court's determinations, which may be appropriate, but here, well, I guess what troubles me, and maybe it's just my sense of the defense attorney's testimony, so correct me if I'm wrong, but essentially that his defense attorney testified that he didn't evaluate Epps' mental health because he believed, based on what he had experienced with Mr. Epps, they had this present ability that you referred to and was competent at the time.
Right.
Now, in light of Dr. Cranbrook's testimony that when she reads the transcript, she sees all kinds of evidence of things that relate back to Mr. Epps' prior delusional behaviors, does that testimony from the defense attorney suggest that the defense attorney just didn't think about this hard enough in light of what he did? He was aware that there had been issues with Mr. Epps' competency, right, but he didn't investigate it.
Mm-hmm. And I believe he was looking at the issue correctly. He was aware of the prior finding of incompetence. He was aware of his client's view on his prior cases, on his criminal history, and was able to rationally consult, reasonably participate, and understand what was going on. And so I think, therefore, you know, his duty to investigate further was not triggered. And so I don't think there was any reason for him to need to dive deeper. You know, I think Dr. Cranbrook's testimony, you know, it also showed that while, you know, it was kind of this general cynical view of the system, and she was being pointed out instances of that in the plea and sentencing transcript of Mr. Epps' general cynical view, but she did not point out the overt specific delusions that he had been espousing back in 2014 of, you know, fabricated transcripts or altered transcripts, hearings that hadn't happened, things of that nature. I see my time is up, and so I would just ask the court to affirm the post-conviction court's denial of relief in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Were there any other questions for the panel?
I do actually have one.
Yeah.
So this the reason to doubt, and looking at, you know, the district court's articulation of the standard expressed in Adebayo, talks about reasonably competent attorney. Should a reasonably competent attorney have any level of education or understanding of mental illness, mental health, or is it totally a layperson's understanding? Like, do I think that person understands what I'm saying just because I talk to people all the time and I've had years of experience of talking to people? Mm. I mean, it's a fine distinction perhaps, but...
I mean, I know in this case the defense attorney did testify that he has had training on the Rule 20 process and the Rule 20 standard. I can't remember if he'd had any other mental health specific training. You know, I agree with appellant's position that lawyers are not experts in mental health and we shouldn't be held to that standard. But the rule does impose on us, you know, the threshold question of, is there doubt as to this person's competency? So I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Yeah. It's kind of a, I don't know, not the clearest question. So that's fine. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
So we've talked a little bit about Adebayo and whether the attorney was required to move for the evaluation. I think one of the big distinctions in this case is that the deficient performance that I'm focusing on is the lack of investigation, the failure to investigate in obvious areas. One of the things that I'm highlighting is kind of maybe low-hanging fruit, that he knows that there's a prior opinion and says, I'm not going to look at it.
So are you sort of analogizing to the general duty of investigation that a defense attorney has, you know, the duty to investigate the case itself? I mean, is that a similar kind of rule that you're asking for here?
Your Honor, the distinction between the Strickland standard and the duty to investigate relevant to competence does come down to the distinction between strategic investigation and mandatory investigation. So I'm hoping that the opinion from this court concludes that there's a mandatory investigation into mental health, because there is no strategy to plead guilty when the client lacks the capacity to waive his fundamental rights.
And, like, what's a sufficient investigation? What is the standard there?
Again, I think the low-hanging fruit is, and this has come up in the cases that I've litigated, it came up in Trevino, it came up in Derschmidt. There's one pending in this court that there isn't a decision in Wachter. The lawyers know that these evaluations exist, and they're just not reading them. So there's more than one way to do it. I mean, one is to educate themselves with prior evaluations. Another is to solicit a private investigator. Attorneys commonly express concern that if they are too quick to move for a competency evaluation, it could result in negative outcomes to their client, like longer periods of incarceration. Remember, in this case, he pled guilty to get out immediately.
Yeah, I mean, that did occur to me because he was really angry at the unexplained 24-hour delay. Yeah.
He was certainly upset about it, but I think irrationally upset about it, and maybe it speaks to why there was a competency concern. But to further the point, attorneys can avoid that kind of conflict by soliciting funds from the court to have an independent examiner evaluate their client's mental health. They do it in 2001 settings. They definitely do it in 2002 settings. It's a totally common and reasonable practice for the attorneys to investigate their client's mental health relevant to competence in more than one way, particularly where a prior opinion doesn't exist. I could liken it to Padilla. No one in the defense bar is also an immigration expert. We have in our organization a Padilla expert. We consult that person to try and understand the consequences that can result from a guilty plea in the immigration sphere, because we don't really practice in immigration law as public defenders, but we're expected under Padilla to know the immigration consequences. So we consult experts in immigration law, so I don't think it's much of a stretch to expect defense attorneys to consult the appropriate expert when it comes to competency, because it's something that's not waivable, it's not strategic, it's automatic, resulting from their client's mental illness. Under the facts of this case, the obvious scope of investigation is to read the prior evaluations. Maybe after reading the prior evaluations, they get the private evaluator, or the attorney says, hey, guess what? The court has private evaluators has evaluators on staff through the Rule 20 process to make sure that their client is competent, but for taking what on its face looks like a pretty good deal, but that's not the standard. So that's the main thing I want to distinguish. I'm hoping for a question in my last minute, is that I'm not hanging my hat on the generalized duty to move for a competency evaluation. I'm taking it a step further, that an attorney can't decide whether it's appropriate to move for an evaluation unless they've done a sufficient investigation and they put their head in the sand and ignore obvious signs of mental illness or fail to recognize it and fail to investigate it. Well, it's not so reasonable under the objective standard to fail to move for the evaluation under those facts. So I'm asking this court to reverse either Mr. Epps' conviction or Mr. Epps' sentence, because there was reason to doubt his competence and his attorney failed to conduct any investigation at all into his very obvious mental health concerns.
Anything else from the panel? Looks like the answer is no. Thank you very much, counsel. Thanks to both lawyers in this case for everything you've presented today. We very much appreciate this chance to talk to you about the case. It's now submitted to the court for a decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.